In this view, the most productive way for executives to spend their time is to study what it is about the likes of Stephen King, Madonna, or Bruce Willis that appeals to so many fans. They study the past and, as I've just argued, have no trouble extracting reasons for whatever success they are attempting to explain. They then try to replicate it. That is the deterministic view of the marketplace, a view in which it is mainly the intrinsic qualities of the person or the product that govern success. But there is another way to look at it, a non-deterministic view. In this view, there are many high-quality but unknown books, singers, actors, and what makes one or another come to stand out is largely a conspiracy of random and minor factors, that is, luck. In this view, the traditional executives are just spinning their wheels. Thanks to the internet, this idea has been tested. Researchers who tested it focused on the music market, in which internet sales are coming to dominate. For their study, they recruited 14,341 participants who were asked to listen to, rate, and if they desired, download 48 songs by bands they had not heard of. Some of the participants were also allowed to view data on the popularity of each song, that is, on how many fellow participants had downloaded it. These participants were divided into 8 separate worlds and could see only the data on downloads of people in their own world. All the artists in all the worlds began with 0 downloads, after which each world evolved independently. There was also a 9th group of participants who were not shown any data. The researchers employed the popularity of the songs in this latter group of insulated listeners to define the intrinsic quality of each song, that is, its appeal in the absence of external influence. If the deterministic view of the world were true, the same songs ought to have dominated in each of the 8 worlds, and the popularity rankings in those worlds ought to have agreed with the intrinsic quality as determined by the isolated individuals. But the researchers found exactly the opposite. The popularity of individual songs varied widely among the different worlds, and different songs of similar intrinsic quality also varied widely in their popularity. For example, a song called Lockdown by a band called 52 Metro ranked 26 out of 48 in intrinsic quality, but was the number one song in one world and the number 40 song in another. In this experiment, as one song or another by chance got an early edge in downloads, its seeming popularity influenced future shoppers. It's a phenomenon that is well known in the movie industry. Moviegoers will report liking a movie more when they hear beforehand how good it is. In this example, small chance influences created a snowball effect and made a huge difference in the future of the song. Again, it's the butterfly effect. In our lives, too, we can see through the microscope of close scrutiny that many major events would have turned out differently were it not for the random confluence of minor factors, people we've met by chance, job opportunities that randomly came our way. For example, consider the actor who, for 7 years starting in the late 1970s, lived in a 5th-floor walk-up on 49th Street in Manhattan, struggling to make a name for himself. He worked off-Broadway, sometimes far off, and in television commercials, taking all the steps he could to get noticed, build a career, and earn the money to eat an occasional hanger steak in a restaurant without having to duck out before the check arrived. And like many other wannabes, no matter how hard this aspiring actor worked to get the right parts, make the right career choices, and excel in his trade, his most reliable role remained the one he played in his other career, as a bartender. Then one day in the summer of 1984, he flew to Los Angeles, either to attend the Olympics, if you believe his publicist, or to visit a girlfriend, if you believe the New York Times. Whichever account is accurate, one thing is clear. The decision to visit the West Coast had little to do with acting and much to do with love, or at least the love of sports. Yet, it proved to be the best career decision he ever made. Most likely the best decision of his life. The actor's name is Bruce Willis. And while he was in Los Angeles, an agent suggested he go on a few television auditions. One was for a show in its final stages of casting. The producers already had a list of finalists in mind. But in Hollywood, nothing is final until the ink on the contract is dry and the litigation is ended. Willis got his audition and landed the role, that of David Addison, the male lead paired with Sybil Shepherd in a new ABC offering called Moonlighting. It might be tempting to believe that Willis was the obvious choice over Mr. X, the fellow at the top of the list when the newcomer arrived, and that the rest is, as they say, history. Since in hindsight we know that Moonlighting and Willis became huge successes, it is hard to imagine the assemblage of Hollywood decision-makers, upon seeing Willis, doing anything but lighting up stogies as they celebrated their brilliant discovery and put to flame their now outmoded list of finalists. But what really happened at the casting session is more like what you get when you send your kids out for a single gallon of ice cream and two want strawberry while the third demands triple chocolate fudge brownie. The network executives fought for Mr. X, their judgment being that Willis did not look like a serious lead. Glenn Carson, Moonlighting's executive producer, argued for Willis. It is easy, looking back, to dismiss the network executives as ignorant buffoons. In my experience, television producers often do, especially when the executives are out of earshot. But before we make that choice, consider this. Television viewers at first agreed with the executives' mediocre assessment. Moonlighting debuted in March 1985 to low ratings and continued with a mediocre performance through the rest of its first season. Only in the second season did viewers change their minds, and the show become a major hit. Willis's appeal and his success were apparently unforeseeable, until, of course, he suddenly became a star. One might at this point chalk up the story to crazy Hollywood, but Willis's drunkard's walk to success is not at all unusual. A path punctuated by random impacts and unintended consequences is the path of many successful people, not only in their careers, but also in their loves, hobbies, and friendships. In fact, it is more the rule than the exception. I was watching late-night television recently when another star, though not one from the entertainment world, appeared for an interview. His name is Bill Gates. Though the interviewer is known for his sarcastic approach, toward Gates he seemed unusually deferential. Even the audience seemed to ogle Gates. The reason, of course, is that for 13 years straight, Gates was named the richest man in the world by Forbes magazine. In fact, since founding Microsoft, Gates has earned more than $100 a second. And so when he was asked about his vision for interactive television, everyone waited with great anticipation to hear what he had to say. But his answer was ordinary, no more creative, ingenious, or insightful than anything I've heard from a dozen other computer professionals. Which brings us to this question. Does Gates earn $100 per second because he is godlike? Or is he godlike because he earns $100 per second? In August 1980, when a group of IBM employees working on a secret project to build a personal computer flew to Seattle to meet with the young computer entrepreneur, Bill Gates was running a small company, and IBM needed a program, called an operating system, for its planned home computer. Recollections of the ensuing events vary, but the gist goes like this. Gates said he couldn't provide the operating system, and referred the IBM people to a famed programmer named Gary Kildall at Digital Research Incorporated. The talks between IBM and Kildall did not go well. For one thing, when IBM showed up at DRI's offices, Kildall's then-wife, the company's business manager, refused to sign IBM's non-disclosure agreement. The IBM emissaries called again, and that time Kildall did meet with them. No one knows exactly what transpired in that meeting, but if an informal deal was made, it didn't stick. Around that time, one of the IBM employees, Jack Sams, saw Gates again. They both knew of another operating system that was available, a system that was, depending on whom you ask, based on or inspired by kill dolls. According to Sams, Gates said, "Do you want to get that operating system, or do you want me to?" Sams, apparently not appreciating the implications, said, "By all means, you get it." Gates did, for $50,000, or by some accounts a bit more, made a few changes, and renamed it DOS, Disk Operating System. IBM, apparently with little faith in the potential of its new idea, licensed DOS from Gates for a low per-copy royalty fee, letting Gates retain the rights. DOS was no better, and many, including most computer professionals, would claim far worse than, say, Apple's Macintosh operating system. But the growing base of IBM users encouraged software developers to write for DOS, thereby encouraging prospective users to buy IBM machines, a circumstance that in turn encouraged software developers to write for DOS. In other words, as W. Brian Arthur would say, people bought DOS because people were buying DOS. In the fluid world of computer entrepreneurs, Gates became the molecule that broke from the pack. Had it not been for Kildall's uncooperativeness, IBM's lack of vision, or the second encounter between Sams and Gates, despite whatever visionary or business acumen Gates possesses, he might have become just another software entrepreneur rather than the richest man in the world. And that is probably why his vision seems like that of just that, another software entrepreneur. Our society can be quick to make wealthy people into heroes and poor ones into goats. That's why the real estate mogul Donald Trump, whose Plaza Hotel went bankrupt and whose casino empire went bankrupt twice, a shareholder who invested $10,000 in his casino company in 1994, would, 13 years later, have come away with $636. Nevertheless, dared to star in a wildly successful television program in which he judged the business acumen of aspiring young people. Obviously, it can be a mistake to assign brilliance in proportion to wealth. We cannot see a person's potential, only his or her results. So we often misjudge people by thinking that the results must reflect the person. The normal accident theory of life shows not that the connection between actions and rewards is random, but that random influences are as important as our qualities and actions. On an emotional level, many people resist the idea that random influences are important, even if, on an intellectual level, they understand that they are. If people underestimate the role of chance in the careers of moguls, do they also downplay its role in the lives of the least successful? In the 1960s, that question inspired the social psychologist Melvin Lerner to look into society's negative attitudes toward the poor. Realizing that few people would engage in extended activity if they believed that there were a random connection between what they did and the rewards they received, Lerner concluded that, for the sake of their own sanity, people overestimate the degree to which ability can be inferred from success. We are inclined, that is, to see movie stars as more talented than aspiring movie stars, and to think that the richest people in the world must also be the smartest. We might not think we judge people according to their income or outward signs of success, but even when we know for a fact that a person's salary is completely random, many people cannot avoid making the intuitive judgment that salary is correlated with worth. Melvin Lerner examined that issue by arranging for subjects to sit in a small darkened auditorium facing a one-way mirror. From their seats, these observers could gaze into a small well-lit room containing a table and two chairs. The observers were led to believe that two workers, Tom and Bill, would soon enter the room and work together for 15 minutes, unscrambling anagrams. The curtains in the front of the viewing window were then closed, and Lerner told the observers that he would keep the curtain shut because the experiment would go better if they could hear but not see the workers, so that they would not be influenced by their appearance. He also told them that because his funds were limited, he could pay only one of the workers, who would be chosen at random. As Lerner left the room, an assistant threw a switch that began to play an audio tape. The observers believed they were listening in as Tom and Bill entered the room behind the curtain and began their work. Actually, they were listening to a recording of Tom and Bill reading a fixed script, which had been constructed such that, by various objective measures, each of them appeared to be equally adept and successful at his task. Afterward, the observers, not knowing this, were asked to rate Tom and Bill on their effort, creativity, and success. When Tom was selected to receive the payment, about 90% of the observers rated him as having made the greater contribution. When Bill was selected, about 70% of the observers rated him higher. Despite Tom and Bill's equivalent performance, and the observers' knowledge that the pay was randomly assigned, the observers perceived the worker who got paid as being better than the one who had worked for nothing. Alas, as all of those who dress for success know, we are all too easily fooled by the money someone earns. A series of related studies investigated the same effect from the point of view of the workers themselves. Everyone knows that bosses with the right social and academic credentials and a nice title and salary have at times put a higher value on their own ideas than on those of their underlings. Researchers wondered, will people who earn more money purely by chance behave the same way? Does even unearned success instill a feeling of superiority? To find out, pairs of volunteers were asked to cooperate on various pointless tasks. In one task, for instance, a black-and-white image was briefly displayed, and the subjects had to decide whether the top or the bottom of the image contained a greater proportion of white. Before each task began, one of the subjects was randomly chosen to receive considerably more pay for participating than the other. When that information was not made available, the subjects cooperated pretty harmoniously. But when they knew how much they each were getting paid, the higher-paid subjects exhibited more resistance to input from their partners than the lower-paid ones. Even random differences in pay led to the backward inference of differences in skill, and hence to the development of unequal influence. It's an element of personal and office dynamics that cannot be ignored. But it is the other side of the question that was closer to the original motivation for Lerner's work. With a colleague, Lerner asked whether people are inclined to feel that those who are not successful or who suffer deserve their fate. In that study, small groups of female college students gathered in a waiting room. After a few minutes, one was selected and let out. That student, whom I will call the victim, was not really a test subject, but had been planted in the room by the experimenters. The remaining subjects were told that they would observe the victim working at a learning task, and that each time she made an incorrect response, she would receive an electric shock. The experimenter adjusted some knobs, said to control the shock levels, and then a video monitor was turned on. The subjects watched as the victim entered an adjoining room, was strapped to a shock apparatus, and then attempted to learn pairs of nonsense syllables. During the task, the victim received several apparently painful electric shocks for her incorrect responses. She reacted with exclamations of pain and suffering. In reality, the victim was acting, and what played on the monitor was a pre-recorded tape. At first, as expected, most of the observers reported being extremely upset by their peers' unjust suffering. But as the experiment continued, their sympathy for the victim began to erode. Eventually, the observers, powerless to help, instead began to denigrate the victim. The more the victim suffered, the lower their opinion of her became. As Lerner had predicted, the observers had a need to understand the situation,